Well, I'm Emily Curitan, and if I told you right now that I'm the usual Jefferson Exchange host, Jeffrey Riley, no one would probably believe me. But what if Jeffrey Riley friended you on Facebook, followed you on Twitter, or sent you an email? Would you believe it was the real Jeffrey Riley? How would you even know? This is just one example of the type of lies we're told through the internet. Our guest today has analyzed the whole depressing array of ways to get suckered by digital deceivers. Charles Seif is a professor of journalism at New York University. He's written for Science Magazine, Scientific American, ProPublica, The New York Times, and a whole lot of other very credible publications. He's written 6 interesting books, and his latest is Virtual Unreality, The New Era of Digital Deception, out in paperback now. Charles Seif, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We hope it's really you.
It is. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So you studied math at Princeton and Yale. How did you come to be so interested in human credibility?
I went from mathematics, which was kind of cold but very interesting, to journalism, which is very very much interested in human conduct, but not so quantitative. So I became kind of a science journalist over time, and that allowed me to combine the quantitative with the human. And this is really kind of an example of that, where you've got dynamics created by a machine, by a system that imposes its will in some ways upon a chaotic, interesting group of creatures, us.
That would be us, humankind, which last I checked, we've been lying since the Dark Ages, maybe before. Your new book, Virtual Unreality, or new in paperback anyway, talks about how lying has changed in the digital age. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of why our deceits are so different now?
Yeah. It's actually something that we humans haven't gotten a handle on yet, because the way we interact with the world is completely different now that we live in a digital age. That in some ways, in 40 years ago, our way of interacting with the world was through our personal senses. We would see something. At most, you'd get some media which would act as a proxy for our senses, that you'd read the newspapers, you'd see the television. But when you were interacting with people, you were interacting with your own senses. You were speaking to them. You were seeing them. You were shaking hands with them. Now that we live in an environment where many of our social interactions are mediated by the internet, that we are avatars, we are little virtual creations on the internet that may or may not be real, we are interacting with creatures that we don't really have a handle on reality. And because we don't know them personally, we don't know who they are, where they come from, we don't know whether someone actually is who he or she is, we have the ability to create our own realities, that because we're not seeing things with our own eyes anymore, but through the medium of a computer, people who are able to manipulate the computers can manipulate our perception of reality.
So you've likened, in your book, Virtual Unreality, you've likened digital information to a virus. Who or what is the host in that analogy?
Yeah, well, we're the host. That information, you can think of information as, I mean, really very much like a virus. That it is a packet of something which spreads from host to host, from person to person. And because digital information is transmitted on the internet, it goes at the speed of light. And so unlike a real virus where it kind of has to spread through physical contact, through person sneezing on another person, you put something on the internet and everyone in the world, theoretically, is exposed to it instantly. But you put something on Twitter, you, in theory, can have 1 billion people see that right away. And that's another element of the digital environment, which is different, that it used to be really, really hard to get an audience for an idea.
You had to be saying something interesting, right?
Yeah, you had to be saying something interesting, and you had to have access to some sort of amplifying mechanism. Put something in the media or get people to spread your words somehow. You had to be a good speaker and have a good pulpit for your ideas to get across. Nowadays, everyone can do this if they hit the Twitter lottery. You put something on Twitter, you put something on YouTube, and it can go instantly viral, and 1 billion people can be exposed to your ideas with very little infrastructure.
I think that you're wording these amplifying devices. You are a journalism professor at New York University. What has the proliferation of digital information done to our amplifiers, our media, and journalism as a whole?
It's put our amplifiers up to 11. It has completely changed everything, and for good and for bad. My book is a bit pessimistic, and what I talk about are the downsides of the digital information era. It has completely changed our relationship in good ways as well as bad. You might have an argument in a bar about some obscure fact about the War of 1812 or whatever, and have a really difficult time finding out the answer to this problem. And now you can just throw it in a question to Google, and odds are you can get a pretty good answer very quickly.
That does make for less interesting conversations, I would opine there. When people whip out the phone and there's an answer, you know. And part of your book is talking about how those answers that we think of as so readily, so instantly, we almost expect them, or we do expect them. Now, they're not always correct just because they're on the Internet, are they?
That's right. The upside to universal information is that we have it accessible. The downside is that the Wikipedia and information sources like that are not just universally accessible, but universally editable and changeable. And there are people with agendas who can alter Wikipedia to not reflect reality, or even to say something which is actively false. There are plenty of examples of falsehoods that are completely created out of Wikipedia. And you can search, for example, not so long ago, a cookbook had a completely wrong definition of a dish based upon a Wikipedia hoax.
Well, we'll talk more about Wikipedia and all the other ways to kind of lose track of the truth online with Charles Seif, author of the book Virtual Unreality, joining us here on the Jefferson Exchange today with me, your host, Emily Curitan. You can join the conversation 800-838-3760 or email us jx@jeffnet.org. We'll be back after a short break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Charles Seif, author of the book Virtual Unreality. You can join us 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Charles, before the break, we were talking about Wikipedia, which in your book Virtual Unreality, you've likened to that old eccentric uncle, full of wisdom to be taken with a grain of salt. Who or what then is Facebook?
Facebook is probably your nosy neighbor looking in your window.
Uh-huh.
Facebook is actually, again, it's one of these organizations which has cropped up to mediate our social interactions. Facebook is a company which connects us with others. And to an increasing extent, that we are dependent upon Facebook to help us connect, that we no longer go and call people up on the phone or meet people face-to-face, that we press a button on Facebook to give them a little like and we're done for the day. And because of this, Facebook has a tremendous amount of power, not just to control whom we connect with and how and whom we meet and why, but also to control the information that we get from our friends. Actually, last year there was a very controversial paper that came out in a scientific journal where Facebook was manipulating what users saw in their feeds from their friends.
A little social engineering there, or for marketing purposes, both, I guess.
Well, the experiment was for social engineering, but the function is ultimately for marketing.
Yeah, has a company like Facebook, any company ever had as much information about individuals as Facebook does, and we give it to them freely?
Yes, I mean Google has, as far as we know, never deleted a single search query.
Wow!
That every single time you enter anything into Google, It is stored and more likely than not tagged with lots of information about who you are and where you are. And that means that Google, I mean, you search things about the strange warts that you find in your inner thigh, or it knows all your intimate secrets because we interact with our search engine to find out about the world, that we need it. It's like another pair of eyes. But
to Google something has entered the vocabulary. I guess a lot of words have been born from the internet in the past couple of days, but it's synonymous with finding stuff out, to Google it.
Yeah, and it's like another sense that we have, but this is a sense that is owned by a corporate entity that is gathering information about us and selling it to others.
And that raises some very interesting issues, or has raised, about privacy. Do you get into this in virtual and reality, especially, you know, I don't really think about privacy in a legal sense without the words "the expectation of" coming to mind. What are our expectations online? Do they exist? Are they legally protected when it comes to privacy?
It's actually a complicated question. I mean, the strongest privacy that we have is if we encrypt anything. It is illegal to decrypt anything. But things that are kind of out in the open, especially if they're going through an intermediary like Facebook, we really don't have an expectation of privacy with regard to these companies. So they have access because we know that they have access. And buried like three links down somewhere in the bottom, there's a terms of service that you agreed to but probably didn't read that states that Facebook can do whatever it wants with their posts.
Is that was going to be a question I was building up to. Those terms of service agreements, they're like these jargon-filled novels that I'm pretty sure everyone skips to the bottom of. Are we signing away our privacy or more with those things? Or does it depend on the company?
It depends largely on the company, but generally speaking, the companies reserve all rights, that they can do whatever they want. And in fact, if you read very carefully, some of these places, especially if you do any writing online, if you do blogging or things like that, you will find clauses that say if they get sued, you will sometimes have to pay them for their defense.
Has that actually happened?
I'm not sure, actually, about many of these companies, but these indemnity clauses are fairly famous in the publishing industry. I mean, if you're a freelance writer, you have to always look to see whether you're covering the magazine you're working for or vice versa.
So, you know, as a professor at NYU teaching journalism, maybe you get the question I'm about to ask from your students, but we're talking about Facebook and social media and kind of focusing on the very dark side of common sense. Why would we give one company all of this power? All information is power. It's a cliche. It's probably also true. But on the flip side, as an individual, I sometimes have this feeling that if I'm not online, if I'm not engaging in social media, I don't really exist in a reality that, for better or worse, is very important for being invited to parties or being an engaged citizen or getting that freelance job. Have you heard this from your students, and how do you respond?
Oh, absolutely. My students, I'm 20 years older than my students, and I come from a different generation, a generation which didn't grow up with the internet. We do have very different values about privacy. That the idea of sharing so much of one's personal life with a company doesn't bother them in the same way that it bothers me. And maybe I'm a fogey in that way. But it's very hard to opt out, because in as much as a society chooses to operate in one way, you have to conform to that way to a certain extent. That your phrase expectation is actually very, very important here, because if society doesn't expect to keep something private, it's really hard for you to try to bust that expectation and keep it private anyhow.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something there, the different expectations of someone who's, say, 15 to 30 years old and someone who maybe is 35 and older, maybe even older than that. I'm not sure where we draw the line. But to me, Facebook is a public space, and maybe to others, they don't they don't agree. What do you think? We are talking here today with Charles Seif, the author of the book Virtual Unreality, out in paperback now. I'm Emily Curitan in for Jeffrey Riley today, and happy to hear from you at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Now, Charles, this is another big question. I apologize in advance, but how does digital technology, we're just talking about Facebook and kind of dogging on it a little bit, how does this kind of technology and get people to act against their own self-interest, say privacy in this case?
Yeah, well, it's basically because the interactions are such, you can have interactions with real friends and real genuine people. And you can also, because you've got a network, you can have other people influencing the network. That you can have Pepsi come in and be your friend on some level. They can either have a Pepsi account and you get free stuff by sharing details or sharing your friends' email addresses. And in some ways, I mean, if you think about it, sharing email addresses many years ago was kind of considered taboo because spam filters were very poor. And the moment your email was out there, you started getting spam. But a number of websites emerged that were very useful to people, like Evite or various services that ask for people's email addresses. LinkedIn is another good example of this. And so people to use that site would give their friends all their mail, all the friends' emails into the service. And it might piss off some of their friends because of this. So in some ways, you were using LinkedIn and possibly annoying your real friends to get the advantage provided by the LinkedIn service. And this is kind of a dynamic that you give up something, that you annoy people, that you put a little spam in their inbox, or you fill up their Twitter feed with corporate sponsorship, and in return you get a benefit.
And have you studied at all whether the payoff is worth it? Are people richer, happier? Are they getting the status that they're trading their friends in for?
Well, I know that some people certainly are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at, say, the Kardashians, their follower network is they're getting a lot of money for having their followers read semi-advertisement posts. And if this were a real, genuine relationship, I mean, imagine if one-third of your conversations with a friend of yours were an advertisement for a clothing line. You probably wouldn't stay friends with that person anymore. But this is kind of the expected nature of interactions online nowadays.
Well, we've been focusing on social media because I think I was reading recently about Facebook launching a news viewer in that because so many people use Facebook now as a portal to the rest of the unimaginably expansive internet. They're going through social media and it's all got the blue banner and everything on it. But maybe we could switch to different quadrants of cyberspace where deception is rampant. Does that ring any bells for you moving away from social media? Where's ground zero for the dupes?
Yeah, well, there's always the standard email scams. I'm sure all of you in your inbox, if you check your spam filter, you've probably gotten 7 or 8 emails today from a Nigerian prince or someone who's asking for money.
Just 5,000 euros, no big.
Exactly. This is a scam that went back centuries, that it was written up in the New York Times in the 1800s.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and it was very successful. Because, I mean, if written well, it's a convincing thing that I have a treasure. If you just give me a little bit of money, I can help you get this treasure. And then it kind of lures people in. And it worked. People made money off of the scheme, but it was limited by the fact that they had to write these letters by hand. And correct them.
That might add some credibility to it as well, like a calligraphic stroke saying that you're a prince who needs $1,500. But I'm having a hard time believing anybody ever fell for that. But you're saying it doesn't take many if it's proliferated digitally.
Yeah, because you can send out to 100,000 people at the press of a button. If 2 in 1,000 people are dumb enough to take that seriously or even give a second look, you are way ahead of the game. So even the dumbest schemes, just by virtue of being proliferated at such a great rate, is going to meet with some success. And that's why all of these schemes are tremendously out there. They're way more than you would ever get through regular mail. So that's one element. So email scam. There's sock puppetry, which is another element that we're increasingly dependent upon reviews, not from professional reviewers that we trust, not from the movie reviewers, the food critic in the New York Times, but from things that you see in Yelp or Amazon.com. And people will say, you assume that they are being honest when they talk about this restaurant being great or the service being poor. But increasingly, there are not just services, but individuals are gaming these reviews to either help their own businesses or hurt competitors. And this sort of thing is not that surprising, but because the digital is shifting the power from the traditional media gatekeepers, the film reviewer that you would trust, Roger Ebert or something like that, to a million little Eberts, is really much easier to swamp the signal and make sure that people believe what you want them to believe.
And what kinds of, it strikes me as a little bit of an irony that by opening up information and having those millions, billions maybe of little Eberts, we're kind of unloosing anarchy. And then with something like Wikipedia, it almost corrects itself through the massiveness of it. You know, if someone goes in and changes something to make it wrong, someone else will come along and say, no, like we by our numbers, we are creating a moral conscience. Is that the case at all on the internet? Is there a moral conscience?
Well, the phrase that people like to use is the wisdom of crowds, that if you aggregate enough minds, generally speaking, it will move in the right direction. And I have to say Wikipedia is a great achievement. It is generally a pretty decent resource on incredible range of things. There is some wisdom to the crowds, but at the same time that a malefactor, someone who wants to get you to believe something, has the ability to fool the crowd much of the time, that the Wikipedia hoaxes are rampant, that using Wikipedia for PR purposes, that a company will tinker with its Wikipedia page, it's a very common practice, and it's so much easier to change people's perception by tinkering with a Wikipedia page than actually changing your corporate practices. That this is an example of, again, tinkering with the very fabric of reality, people's perception, by altering the information that they get rather than actually altering the reality.
Oh, and you say tinkering with the fabric of reality. It makes me think of some peaceful activities in a sewing room, maybe. But there'd be some big fallout from that. We've talked about, you know, the things that can happen to individuals, or I've watched thoughtless tweets basically ruin someone's life. Which digital deceptions stick out to you for the harm they have caused in real life?
Well, one stems from the fact that fringe ideas, because of this amplification factor, things that might be believed by just 1 in 100,000 people can actually wind up getting collected and transmitted and believed on the internet because you can have these people interact with one another. So fringe ideas get amplified in a way that they wouldn't in an ordinary pre-digital society. And one of these beliefs that I think got a lot of amplification was HIV denialism. And in the late 80s, early 90s especially, there was a lot of noise about whether the HIV virus actually caused the AIDS syndrome. And it wound up kind of there was this alternative group that believed in that AIDS was caused not just by drugs, but also by the antiretroviral drugs that were used to cure AIDS. And so it was a really pernicious thing. But it really took off when the internet got going, and it spread worldwide. And it really took root in South Africa, where the AIDS problem was tremendous. During one administration, in fact, the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, managed to, from the internet, gather this information, and he was single-handedly responsible for blocking the use of certain AIDS drugs for a number of years. And there was a study not so long ago that calculated the number of people who died as a result of that not having that therapy. It was in the order of several hundred thousand.
Wow. Hard to follow that. It's unthinkable. Perhaps some of the diabolical power of this is that there's a domino effect. One person doesn't mastermind, or a snowball effect, more like it. Do you agree with that? That an action like, say, saying Bert is evil of Sesame Street can become something that the person who said it didn't intend?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great example of this, where not long after the September 11th attacks, Bert, the Muppet, wound up in pro-Osama bin Laden posters. And it was a very strange story that couldn't have happened before the internet.
Yeah, a lot of strange stories in your book, Charles, A Virtual Unreality. We're talking today with Charles Seif. If you want to join the discussion, maybe the internet has ruined your life and it's time to share, or any other stories about being deceived online, we'd love to hear them. 800-838-3760 or email us at jx@jeffnet.org. I'm Emily Curitan in for Jeffrey Riley today. We will be back on the other side of a short break with your phone calls and more with Charles Seif. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange with me, your host, Emily Curitan. Jeffrey Riley has the morning off. We're talking this morning with Charles Seif, a professor of journalism at NYU, author of 6 books, the latest of which tackles lies the internet told you. It's called Virtual Unreality, the new era of digital deception. We have a caller on the line, and you can become, two callers, and you can join the ranks by joining us 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to Wolfgang from Sunny Valley. Wolfgang, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Charles Seif.
Hi there, good morning. This should be a 10-hour show.
All right, thanks for that, Wolfgang.
You know, it's amazing. And it's as diverse as humanity is. Now, internet didn't ruin my life. In fact, I found my wife on the internet. But the question is, why did I find her? Why did I answer a certain ad? Why did you put in a certain ad at a certain time? And it couldn't be any more perfect. That's one thing. The other thing is that, yes, I also was victim of a Wikipedia edit, which somebody did in order to further their business interests. I mean, actually a theater producer in Vienna. And so that's all the stuff that's, yes, we've talked about that. What interests me more is what isolation makes us so susceptible to the advertising media. I mean, all media is advertising. Internet is advertising. You ask a question on the internet, it gets you to a portal, and the portal pops some advertising at you. All the Facebook, Google information is piped to advertising. But why are we so strapped? Why do we get so addicted to the illusion of connectedness?
All right, Wolfgang, let's give Charles Seif a chance to respond. There's actually a title in your book called The Loneliness of the Interconnected.
Yeah, and this hits upon one of the key themes here, is that, you know, the internet provides a great way of connecting across vast distances, across layers of society that you wouldn't ordinarily cross. It's a wonderful commons. where people can interact. And for dating, I mean, it's changed the way people date because you can find people that you would never have found otherwise. So congratulations on finding your wife. That's, I mean, this is one of the great powerful things of the internet. But at the same time, one of the things that we tend to forget is that the online persona that we create, that we are not ourselves walking around in these commons. We are creating representations of us, a simulacra, doppelgangers, that are interacting with one another. And it's the fact that we can alter those doppelgangers more easily than we can alter ourselves, that we can, I can go on the internet and pretend that I am a 70-year-old woman with who owns cats, or a 13-year-old boy who's into Pokemon or something like that. And it would be very hard for anyone else to recognize that this is not reality. So in some ways, it's part of the loneliness comes from the fact that we are interacting not with real people, but with simulacra of people, many of whom are very inauthentic, that it's a created reality rather than an authentic one.
Let's take another call from Joan in Eugene. Joan in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, thank you. I used to enjoy Twitter 6 or 7 years ago, around 2008, 2009. And one day I made the statement, take your money out of the big banks and put it into small banks. And immediately after that, Twitter was sent out in my name, as if it was coming from me, that I was offering sex to people. And so that makes me think that ruining people's reputations through alleged sexual misconduct is a very powerful weapon.
And how did you recover, Joan? Did you delete your account?
I changed my password, but I never did. I don't use Twitter anymore because it just ruined it for me.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, Joan. We appreciate your call. Joan, sounds like you're among many people who have been the victim of online deception. Or is that a form of sock puppetry, Charles Seif?
It can be. Identity theft is in some ways the ultimate sock puppetry. That I can, if I crack your password, I can go to your bank and say, it's me, could you send me a check to such and such an address? So, yeah, that's a very dangerous consequence of the convenience that we get by not having to go visit our bank in person and show our ID to get a teller to do something. So it's the other side of this sword. Just as dangerous, though, is the fact that these online persona that we have are, to some extent, mediated by these companies and changed by these companies, and we do not know who is controlling what other people perceive to be us.
Let's take another call, I think in a similar vein. Maggie in Trinidad, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Maggie in Trinidad, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm in Trinidad, California.
Oh, Trinidad, California. Welcome to the program. Thanks for listening.
I'm calling because I was looking for a place to live, and I was using Craigslist. And I responded to one because it looked like a great place at a great price, and they responded back saying that they were in Africa and they wanted me to mail all this money. And I knew it was a scam, but I think it was this particular person that hacked into my website, and I didn't know to, or sorry, my email. I didn't know to have like a separate dummy one, which I found out later. But I changed my password and did everything I could. And even the other day, my aunt called me and said that she got an email from me saying that I wanted a bunch of money because I was, like, stuck in Europe or whatever. I was wondering, how do I stop that? Or is it too late because they already have my family's email addresses?
I'm afraid it's largely too late. And again, this is a danger because information is a commodity, that you have certain information which is valuable to other people. And like your email address. And once information is out there, it can be replicated and spread infinitely without any benefit to you. And this is actually similar to what's happening in the record industry and in the book industry, that you have a product which is based upon information. Once it is out there, people can duplicate it and send it around without paying you. So you don't know how people are using it. You're not getting any benefit from it. You're not getting any royalties. and yet people are using and abusing your property, your information without your permission. And unfortunately, in your case, I mean, with this fraud, it exposes to you and your family to some real financial danger. I'm sorry to hear that.
I think Maggie, an interesting point in her comments there was that she created a kind of a sham email account in order to interact in public spaces on the internet, like the proliferation of spammers and of sock puppets makes regular people create sock puppets.
Yes. Yeah, you create a throwaway email if you want to interact in a certain way. You have your important account and your not important account, and we will choose our behavior differently depending on whether we're writing from the one account or another. And that just goes to show how we are, our digital environment changes our personalities, the way we interact with the world. And it's not, there's not something fundamental as much, that you can't divorce yourself from the medium you're in. And the digital environment makes that very clear.
So she was asking for advice. Say you do want to, you know, engage on Craigslist or in social media. You want to have an online presence. Do you have to create your own sock puppet to do that and still protect your privacy?
The moment you interact in the public sphere, you are exposing information, and the information that you expose may or may not be used the way you want it. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to interact in certain ways, if you want to get into big fights about that will make people very angry at you and will make you a target, or if you're interacting in ways that kind of make you a target for consumer fraud, then, yeah, it's probably a good idea to create a persona, become a sock puppet yourself, and separate that and very strongly limit the information that you send out there, because it can and will be used against you.
It sounds like a whole lot of intentionality goes into not being victimized on the internet. We're talking with Charles Seif today. I'm Emily Curitan, hosting for Jeffrey Riley. I'm the producer of this show, which means I'm usually behind the scenes making a whole lot of judgment calls about which topics we air and which speakers we invite. This can mean combing through the internet sources for much of the week and trying to determine credibility with very limited information. Charles Seif, do you have any advice for me about how I can avoid being a rube while still keeping a really open and curious mind that's so important for journalism?
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard. It's a hard balance. Because one of the things that the internet has done is it's kind of undermined the concept of authority, what gives someone the right to say something or the ability to say something. So I think that for me, the key to kind of vetting information and vetting people is to go to as deep as you can to the root source of all information. You'll find things repeated via telephone, that so-and-so's had an article and such, and they take a quote out of context. Going back to the original article to make sure that it's the person actually said it and was saying what you thought he said. Going back to the original source is important. And unfortunately, in some ways, some of the mechanisms we deal with, whether to believe somebody or not, are going back to kind of fallacies. The idea that if someone is a professor at a high-level school, you're probably going to take what they say more seriously than someone random on the internet. But of course, this is kind of the argument to authority fallacy. So there is no good, solid way to do it. Every way that we have is unfortunately flawed.
So if we find three sources on the internet, that does not mean something is true.
That's right.
Okay, I'll take that into advisement. Charles Seif, the author of 6 books, the latest one, Virtual Unreality, out in paperback now is what we're talking about. Charles, you've written in that book, much of it is about how we are in an age of more information than has ever been produced ever before in the history of humanity. But you've also written that we're at the beginning of an information famine. How can both be true?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, the Internet of Things, the idea that your oven and your refrigerator and your light bulbs are going to be communicating, and they're going to be sending data about how they are and what environment they're in, there's going to be a flood. And there is already a flood of information, but not just about the information that we create, but the information about how we created the data, what machines we were using to create the data, when it was created, metadata, and all of this is out there and usable and useful to some people. But in all of that flood, it's becoming harder and harder and harder to find what we want and what we need. And in some ways, if you're looking for an expert on a subject, it was easier in some ways to find a genuine expert in the 1950s because there are fewer kind of people who are pretending and fail and not actually fulfilling the bill. So the information famine comes from the fact that for all of this information that's out there, it's getting harder and harder to find the stuff that is useful. And we are increasingly dependent upon companies like Google to filter the good from the bad. And this, again, kind of closes the circle there. We have depended upon companies to mediate kind of something that's become almost like a sense to us, that Google decides what is real and what isn't, what is important, what isn't, how to rank its search results. And we trust it now to tell us where to look.
That seems like the kind of authority that would normally, at least in the modern age, be reserved for a government or a representative body to decide. Or maybe not. I'm thinking of the Fourth Estate. You know, we are the press is lives and dies by their credibility. Do you see the internet developing these checks and balances that maybe will make the situation slightly less depressing 20 years down the road?
I think that some of the checks are in place. I mean, Wikipedia does have a structure to try to sort out fact from fiction. It just doesn't work terribly well. I see some trends that are kind of encouraging, that I do in journalism, see that while a lot of outlets are going for the quick hits, copy and even cut and paste stuff from other places, others are moving towards longer form, more thoughtful journalism that goes deep into raw data. So I think the trend has both good sides and bad sides. I think it's very much up to the audience to determine what survives and what doesn't. If we don't care so much about the quality of our information, then there's no way that the extra effort that's required to separate the good from bad will be worth it. And the people who don't care and provide that information, whether it's good or bad, will win.
Well, this has been a very illuminating conversation with Charles Seif, a professor of journalism at New York University and author of 6 books, the latest, Virtual Unreality, The New Era of Digital Deception, out in paperback now. Charles, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
It was our pleasure.